This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today. Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolios strive to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servant, a local neurologist that practices at the Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville, and this is What's Health Got to Do With It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. And we want to hear from you. If you have a question or story idea, tweet me at jservin, emails at health@wjct.org, or leave us a message at 904-358-6362. And just ahead, a look at how this school year is different from others due to the COVID pandemic, which continues to impact our daily lives on myriad levels. Then, what hidden emergencies are school nurses prepping for? And later, a look at how students and their families can maintain good mental health while going to school during a pandemic. But first this hour, school is back in session as COVID surges on. According to Politico, Florida saw an overall 63% increase in new childhood COVID infections in August, which is the greatest monthly increase in cases for kids since March 2020, with sadly a total of 17 pediatric deaths. Yet so much regarding COVID in schools has been discussed and covered. Most of us can agree it's all about vaccines if it's in the right age group and masking. Yet there's so much nuance on how we manage students in school in navigating these issues. Everything from split families, different aged kids with some vaccinated, some not. Some kids wear masks while others are not. What about sleepovers, sports? How do you fit COVID protocols into all of this? Well, here now to help us navigate these issues and others are Dr. Jeffrey Goldhagen. He's professor in chief at Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at the University of Florida College of Medicine here in Jacksonville. And he's president of the International Society for Social Pediatrics and Child Health and a former director of the Duval County Department of Health. And Dr. Mobeen Rathore, professor and associate chair of the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Florida. He chairs the Infection Prevention and Control Committee for Baptist Health System and is a hospital epidemiologist and chief of pediatric infectious diseases and immunology at Wolfson's Children's Hospital. So Drs. Goldhagen and Rathore, it is a pleasure to have you both here joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you for having us.
We love having you both here, and you're going to help kind of give us some clarity to what's going on. So I'm going to start with Dr. Goldhagen. How has COVID affected schools, teachers, and students this year as we're in a second year of a pandemic that's perhaps different from the previous year?
Well, I think at the first year, we were all together and concerted in our efforts to isolate children in schools. There was six foot spacing. Kids were wearing masks. And in general, we were together on our approach. Then over the past year, and in particular over the last several months, We've deteriorated into a political environment where decisions are not being based on public health, but being based on political considerations. And today I would say that it's far more chaotic than it was previously. The irony is that we know how to protect our children in schools via wearing masks in particular, and for those children that are 12 to 18 years of age, getting them vaccinated. But currently, the politics has taken over, and public health has succumbed to politics, and it's creating a very chaotic environment for families, for children, for teachers, and for staff.
Well stated, Dr. Goldhagen. Dr. Rathore, I'm going to expand that question that I just gave Dr. Goldhagen, which is, what do you see as the biggest issue that's magnifying all of the concerns in terms of managing COVID? Is it the contact tracing, lack of testing? What do you see as the biggest issue at this moment?
Well, you know, thank you so much. For children, I think, first of all, it was this misinformation that children don't get infected. I think this is a virus. The good thing about this virus is it's not discriminated. I say that tongue-in-cheek, of course. And it's an equal opportunity infector, so it'll infect if it finds a susceptible host. So children were always at risk for infection. I think what also was clear that children, when they get infected, they may be asymptomatic or they may have mild symptoms, whereas early in the pandemic, the adults who were getting infected were often the elderly who were had a lot of comorbid health, underlying health conditions. And we also didn't know, honestly, how to manage these patients very well. So those were the ones that were getting attention. They were getting to the hospital, getting sick, intubated, dying for that. And then of course, a vaccine came around and elderly took responsibility, as they often do, and a high percent of elderly got the vaccine. Now, of course, then also we got the Delta variant, and that changed the whole landscape. Now we know that the Alpha virus, the original virus, you know, one person gets infected, well, they may infect two other people. With Delta, it could be 6 to 8 other people. And so now more children are getting infected. Children, of course, did not get into the vaccine game for 6 to 12 and older children quite a bit later than the adults. And we don't have any vaccine for less than 12-year-olds. So as the Delta variant came through, it was infecting a lot more children. And as a lot more children are being infected, you would expect a lot more children also will get sick. And that's what we saw. And they got into the hospital. Many of them got into the ICU. Many of them got intubated and got on a respirator. And some even got ECMO, which, as you know, is our largest effort to support these children with a heart-lung machine. And unfortunately, kids die. So to give you a perspective, in the first 18 months of this pandemic, we had one death every 6 months. In the last 2 months, we had 2 deaths a month. So the whole thing has changed. And I think Jeff, really eloquently answered your question about the schools. The kids are, as the schools opened up, as I think everybody will say, best place for kids is to be in-person, face-to-face schooling, but we can do things that protect those children.
God, so important and so preventable. Dr. Goldhagen, why don't schools seem to respond to COVID the way they have to other conditions that happen in school? I always think of my wife, a former school nurse, always talked about lice outbreaks at the beginning of the year. Why is this different than something like that?
Well, it's clear that in general, the schools want to do what's in the best interest of children to protect them. And so we've seen school systems around the state, including Duval County, make some very courageous decisions that were in conflict with the political decisions that were made by our governor. So I think that schools do want to make the right decisions. Some have been more courageous than others to respond based on evidence-based medicine and public health. The reality in our state, and to a certain extent across the country, and I've been in this field for 40 plus years, I've never been as afraid and as concerned as I am today, because public health has been dismantled in our state. It's been replaced by disinformation, misinformation, political realities and political decisions, and parents are being caught in the middle. As Mo Bean said, children get COVID, they get sick from COVID, they get hospitalized from COVID, and they die from COVID. And parents now are having to make decisions as to whether or not it's safe to send their children into environments in which everyone is not masked. Parents are making decisions that they should not have to make, that should be made on the evidence base of public health and medicine. And so we have dismantled our public health system. And as a result, we see 600,000 to 700,000 deaths across the country. We see tens of thousands of deaths in across the state. We see thousands of deaths in our local communities. And this is the reality that that families are facing. And I think Mobeen would agree that with respect to the volume of COVID patients, our pediatric practices are being inundated. And the number of children with COVID that are being counted in our schools is only a small percentage of the COVID that actually is circulating through our schools.
Just incredible when I listen to all of this. Dr. Rathore, schools have required vaccines from probably its inception. So why is the COVID vaccine any different from any other vaccine that is required?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I ask that question every day myself. I think what we need to be clear is that to protect our children in schools, we have to do a multi-pronged approach. It is not one thing that will work. There's not one answer to this. We have to take a multi-pronged approach, which includes masking first and foremost, especially for those children who cannot get vaccinated, and vaccine for everyone who is eligible, not just the students, but staff and teachers also. I think the other things that we have been touched on, social distancing, good hand hygiene, cough etiquette, but also very critically important is the tracing, tracking and testing, because the numbers that you are seeing clearly are just the tip of the iceberg. What is being reported from the school system is just the tip of the iceberg. I'm certain, you know, that there are a lot more infections than the almost 2,100 cases in students that have been reported so far. So I think, you know, it's about protecting our children. And I'm not sure when in our history or in our life protecting our children became a critical issue. It's a human issue. It's a morality issue. Every good society protects its children. And while we have done that with the vaccine mandates, and we know when you mandate vaccines, kids don't get polio. When you mandate vaccine in the school, people don't get measles or smallpox is eradicated. So I think vaccine mandates is nothing new, by the way. We've had mandate. You know, I heard over the weekend, even George Washington mandated smallpox vaccine or measures for his troops. So this is nothing new. This is part of Americana, it's part of our history that we do what needs to be done to protect our population and especially the vulnerable. And who's more vulnerable than a child who can't speak for themselves?
Well stated. I have a couple of listener questions that came through social media, and I'm going to kind of ask for your advice because they're very practical minded issues along this line. So, Dr. Goldhagen, I'll start from you, from Susan, a mom in Jacksonville. She writes that I have a 5-year-old daughter who is not vaccinated and has health issues. Her ex-husband, the father of the child, does not believe in the vaccine, and his daughter, who is also unvaccinated, helps to babysit when my daughter is at her father's home. How do I navigate the situation between two homes, two different mindsets, for the benefit of my daughter? Do I insist on COVID tests from my ex and her stepsister when she goes there? How do you navigate that in your mind, Dr. Goldhagen?
Well, I'm a pediatrician, not a family therapist.
Fair enough.
So this is going to be really difficult. But from a medical standpoint, I would say very definitively that to whatever extent a parent can limit their the exposure of their child to people who are unmasked and who are not vaccinated, that is in the best interest of their child or their children. so that they should not, parents should not allow their children to go into environments, in particular indoor, where people are unmasked and where people are unvaccinated. How she manages that with her ex-husband is going to be an issue that I can't comment on, but from a medical perspective, the child should not be exposed to unvaccinated and unmasked individuals.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's not an easy situation there. Dr. Rathore, I have a question from Dan, a father in Jacksonville, and he writes, what are the best practices regarding COVID social protocols? Say, for instance, you discover someone in your house has been exposed. Should you be informing everyone you're in contact with about that exposure? And what if your kids are asymptomatic, that is, and they were exposed 5 days ago, they've had negative rapid tests, but haven't been confirmed with a negative PCR. Do they still go to soccer practice or the sleepover? I guess people just want to kind of get a sense of that practical approach in these situations. How much do you follow the information line to all of the folks should someone be exposed in the household with your child?
Well, this is not an unusual situation. We get this question answered all the time. And my first response, as always, everything is contact your pediatrician if your child is exposed. That your pediatrician is your expert, your trusted source, because every situation is individual. Having said that, anybody who is exposed to someone who is infected, and this is significant exposure, they need to be considered what we call person under investigation, meaning either they are infected or they are not. And until we can say that they are not infected, we will assume that they are infected, which means that they should be doing the same isolation and same quarantine if necessary processes. That, yes, you should inform the people they came in contact with it, you know, at places where we play, where we pray, and where we go to school or work. I think that's important. That's how we're going to control and make sure it doesn't spread out of control. So yes, I would say that they inform them, and then they make sure that, you know, if the patient, if the individual needs to be tested who has been exposed, they do get tested. But again, each situation is so individual, the calling your friendly pediatrician is an important part of how you're going to proceed. Let me just add one thing to what Jeff had said at your earlier question. And again, in general, anybody who's not able to get the vaccine for whatever reason, and that's all children less than 12 years of age right now, we need to, what I have been advocating for months now, we need to cocoon those children, meaning everybody around that child needs to be vaccinated. The child needs to wear a mask, and everybody around them need to wear a mask in close proximity if they are exposed or they are infected. And we should, as parents, we should really demand that, you know, that, you know, my child cannot get the vaccine. So anybody, you know, who's going to come in contact with my child needs to be protected. And I think that should be the, in my humble opinion, that's the premise we should work on.
Doctors, we could probably do this for probably hours on end with many questions, but you both have been so incredibly helpful. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Well,
thank you. And thanks for spreading the word.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. Later, recent high school graduates learn an essential life skill not taught in schools. But up next, a school nurse will talk us through how she and her colleagues prepare for hidden emergencies. We'll be right back.
School nurses' most commonly performed tasks include administering routine medications, creating 504 plans, and conducting blood sugar checks.
Welcome back. This is What's Health Got to Do With It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a local neurologist here in Jacksonville, and thanks for listening. When we talk about back to school, there's no issue more concerning to a parent than the health and safety of their child, and not just during a pandemic. And no individual in a school is more frontline in the health of a child than the school nurse. However, we find ourselves in a tenuous situation. The CDC recommends that schools have at least one full-time nurse for every 750 students. Now, when students in schools may need nurses more than ever, It's estimated that a quarter of schools still have no nurse at all, and this is based on Northeast Florida data. Joining us now for a closer look at the essential role of the school nurse is Lisa Morrison, who is a school nurse in Georgia. And Lisa, it is a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you, Josh. I've been doing this about 23 years, and I've seen school nurse evolve probably more so in the last 10 years than ever.
And
so
I
it's very interesting. I'm glad you're interested in it.
We are delighted to have you here and definitely interested. So I guess let's kind of start off with the most basic. What's the most common emergencies you face as a school nurse at school?
You know, it depends on the time of the day, the time of the year, and what's going on. You know, it's kind of the diagnosis du jour. If it's GI stuff, strep throat season, asthma, you know, we see a lot of, you name it, we see it. So, I mean, it could be anything.
Right.
We're like a little mini ER.
About 31, the green bug.
I got it. Ms. Morrison, I'm kind of curious. We talked about the ratio of school nurse to number of students. Roughly, how many students is the typical school nurse responsible for?
Oh, gosh. It just depends on where they're at in Georgia. Some systems are very well staffed with an RN in every school. There's different staffing ratios. National Association of School Nurses, they recommend 1 to 750 students, and that's an RN. But the ratio has dropped a little bit because there's so many kids with chronic health conditions now and very fragile. I mean, people don't even realize that in some schools you have children on ventilators.
Wow.
You know, that may be in that school. So obviously they take more time, and others, you know, with tube feedings, catheters, and everything else.
That's pretty striking. And I bet many of our listeners, including myself, don't often think of school in that manner. I guess it's going to be kind of on the reverse side of that question. I mean, obviously, some schools may not have any nurses. Is there a way to find a way to get them in all schools?
Well, I'm not sure about other states, but I know for Georgia, they're working on some Medicaid expansion services. Several years ago, now this is nationwide, several years ago, IDEA, which is Individual Disabilities Education Act, was passed. I think it was back in the mid to later 90s, 97 maybe. That said that all students could come to school regardless of any kind of impairment they may have, that they are eligible and that we must provide for them. Well, during that time, if you needed to create an individual education plan, an IEP or something like that, Medicaid would help schools that had some of these burdens put on. But of course, it's not a lot. But Georgia has reached out and been working on some funding through Medicaid expansion. Now, I'm not sure about the other states. I've not been involved nationally in probably the last 2 years due to COVID. But it should expand some services for some schools and allow, I know in Georgia, it should allow them to hire some more school nurses if they can find them, because school nurses are very, actually nurses right now are pretty slim to none.
That is so true. And I know everyone is looking for nurses and teachers and so many others. I guess you brought up COVID, so I'll ask it. How has school nursing evolved to include COVID in, you know, in addition to everything else that you worry about at the beginning of the school year, like seizure disorders, asthma, GI, diabetes? How has it evolved?
It's evolved that it's consuming a lot of time. We spend a lot of contact tracing time. We spend a lot of assessing and triaging students and sending them home if they do show up with symptoms. Symptoms are so vague. They could be anything from a scratchy throat to symptoms of a runny nose. You know, generally, they're probably not COVID, the children. However, we have had children that test positive for COVID.
Right.
You know, and their symptoms are much milder. We have also had a lot of staff that have been sick. We're seeing a lot more staff and answering a lot more questions from staff. We've been involved in some, I know in Georgia, nurses all over the state have been working with their health departments and trying to vaccinate staff, and have actually held clinics in their school systems and on the weekend to help vaccinate staff.
Students riding around 30.
I understand. I know you're busy from the sound back there. It sounds like you have to cover not just the students but the teachers, which I imagine is you know just as time consuming and just as important when you're thinking about it. I'm going to play the flip side on the masking question. I know so much goes into the debate on it, but I'm curious whether masking's had some positive benefits. Have you seen a decrease in other conditions, you know, flu, strep, other bugs that are common in school that, you know, would normally be happening, but maybe is less than we've seen?
Well, you know, with COVID, it's kind of hard to tell because with the new variant, you see a lot of GI things. However, last year with masking, we only saw minimal numbers of strep. We saw no flu in several of the school systems I've talked to. And I think it helped. I think a lot of the mitigation helped as well. You know, the wiping of things, the doorknobs, the hand sanitizers, washing hands more frequently is what we preach all the time. But I do think it helped. I don't know how much it helps with COVID because, you know, some kids do not wear their mask properly,
right,
as well as adults. But, you know, I do believe it helped.
You know, I'm curious, as you said, like when you started off, you were telling me about different circumstances and kids and students that you see. For our listeners out there, what do you think is the most common misperception regarding your role as a school nurse that you want to correct right now for us once and for all?
Oh, I love it when people just say, oh, what do you do? She said, you're a school nurse. You're just a school nurse.
Miss all your clothes. Wait a minute.
Go ahead. No, please go ahead with your answer.
Okay. I think probably the most common misconception is that we don't do anything. We spend a lot of time on everything, and it's not just Band-Aids. People will send us little things that have Band-Aids on them, and yeah, that's probably the least of what I do. I manage chronic illnesses and, you know, school nurses do a lot of critical thinking. They're home alone. They're very autonomous. Usually they're very smart and very quick. And we work a lot with the pediatricians and with public health. And I don't think people really stop to think about the link within our community.
No, I can only imagine in many ways the way you describe it, it sounds like a mini emergency room, to be honest with you. What do you think you need from school districts overall to tend to those emergencies that happen at school or caring for these kids and teachers, it sounds like, more effectively? What's on your wish list, if you will?
Oh, gosh. Well, you're saying emergencies. I kind of think of it as more broad. Most nurses need a good team to work with, and most have a good core team within their school system that'll help respond if there is some sort of, you know, just say medical or a first aid emergency that everybody needs to come to. We do have other staff that are CPR trained. Obviously, the nurse can't handle an entire emergency alone. Our SRO is very important. So I think our SRO are a very important piece of that district need. Also, we need parent contacts updated. I know this sounds really basic. Updated health histories, you know, including their immunizations and vision and dental. We need AEDs. I've been very fortunate. I've gotten AEDs for schools all throughout the districts I've worked in.
You mean defibrillators? And is that what you mean by AEDs?
Yes, the defibrillator, the automated defibrillators. I've worked with Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. They have a Project SAVE. It's a sudden cardiac death awareness education program. And so we have AEDs, the automated external defibrillators, in our schools. And we do train our staff on CPR and how to recognize sudden cardiac problems.
It sounds like at the end of the day, if anything, just getting the information that you need, getting all the records in order for you to be able to do your job. Ms. Morrison, Lisa, it has been a pleasure to talk to you. It's also nice to put the spotlight on such an important member of the healthcare team in schools. We really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Appreciate being on the show, and ask the child, please reach out and send chocolate to your school nurses.
I appreciate it. And we love the background noise. It brought me right back to school from once upon a time as I heard it myself. Listen, thank you so much. And we'll be right back. Welcome back. As students return to school, some in person for the first time in a year, there's a lot of talk about keeping children safe from COVID. But what about their mental health? How has the pandemic affected that? According to the most recent National Gallup poll conducted in 2020, nearly 3 in 10, almost 29%, say their child is already experiencing harm to their emotional or mental health because of social distancing and closures. Another 14% indicate their children are approaching their limits, saying that they could continue social distancing a few more weeks until their mental health suffers. But what toll is it taking on kids in our area? And what can we do about this dimension of the pandemic? We have a couple of guests to join us today. Nan, a Jacksonville mother of two, she's going to share a story, who's on the line. And along with Nan, we have Suzanne Melot. She is the executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Health, known as NAMI, here in Jacksonville, and she's here with some advice. So, Nan and Suzanne, it is a pleasure to have you both on today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a pleasure. Nan, I'm going to start with you, and I'm wondering if you could share with all of us your story, your family situation. How has the pandemic affected your kids' mental and emotional well-being?
So my husband is high risk for COVID-19, and we made the decision last year to do remote school with our two daughters who are in middle school. Middle school is hard enough for children, much less with a global pandemic raging in our community. And we noticed about halfway through the school year, around November, one of our daughters was beginning to struggle in school. Her grades started dropping. Her sleep habits changed. She was sleeping a lot more than usual. She was more irritable than a usual young teenage girl. And she just wasn't herself. We had a friend of hers' mother reached out to me and shared some things that my daughter had shared with her friend that, you know, sounded an alarm that we needed to get her into therapy, that there was something was happening, whether it was the isolation from remote school, the stress of you know, what was happening in the world, but she needed more help than what we could provide as loving parents. So we began calling to try to find a therapist to help our daughter that was covered by my insurance. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many offices I called, but I was told many times over again that pediatric psychiatrists and therapists were not seeing new patients. And the one that I finally got through to said they would not be able to see her until October. This was in March.
Oh, wow.
And this was really a more of a crisis situation. She had just really, she was really struggling.
Right.
I had a conversation with her, and she told me how terrible she was feeling inside, and it sounded like severe depression. So we finally, we originally settled on Baptist Behavioral Health had a bridge program here in town that is really designed for 6 weeks of care while you try to find a regular, you know, week to week therapist. You know, you meet with the bridge therapist maybe twice a month or once a month. And we met with the therapist through that program, and it was obvious that she was extremely overwhelmed, that I was going to be able to meet with her maybe once every 3 weeks, and that she needed more more care than what they were able to provide. So we decided just to pay out of pocket. And we have the privilege of making that decision. I feel very lucky that that we do. And it has made all the difference in the world. She's thriving now in middle school. She's back in school. It was a situational depression, I think driven by, you know, overload of screen time and isolation from friends. It's really hard for her not to have friends to talk with and see every day. You know, so important in that age, you identify with a group or a tribe, and remote schoolers really, you know, didn't have that option. But yeah, it was a struggle, and it was shocking as a parent to know that when I had a child in a crisis situation like that, that there's not a lot of help. There's not a lot of help out there for children in that place.
Nan, I really appreciate you sharing that, and I am so sorry that you had to go through that, and my heart goes out. But to hear that she's thriving now, just that just makes me feel so much better. I'm gonna turn to Ms. Melu, that is, with your story. I was curious, Ms. Melu, if you could react to what you just heard. Is this the typical scenario that we find ourselves in for folks like Nan and her kids?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Nan and her family, they're not alone. This is happening more and more often, and particularly because the stresses of the pandemic. So, you know, we do hear these stories often. And, you know, for our local community, it's particularly hard because we thought we were beginning to emerge from behind face masks and quarantine and move into normalcy. And now, you know, we aren't able to put the challenges of 2020 behind us. And once again, we're faced with uncertainty and the fears of an extended pandemic.
So as folks are listening to us, I'm sure some may be wondering, well, what do I do to prevent this? I mean, this was a situational condition. What can students do to care for their mental health proactively? Or what can you help in terms of advice for parents and or students?
Yeah, you know, first, what kids and families need to know is that they're not alone. There are others, and likely there's friends who are feeling the same anxiety or sadness. And so when you begin to open up, you find that many others will open up and you won't feel so alone or even ashamed for having these feelings. So there's a couple things that I think students can and children can do. And one is to acknowledge your feelings. You know, whether they're feeling excited or afraid or sad or anxious, you know, all of these emotions are reasonable reactions to this year's circumstances. And it's important to remember that whatever you're feeling, it's okay. And try your best not to place judgment on these emotions, whether it's yours or your friends. And then you can normalize the conversation, acknowledge and accept your emotions. And that can be extremely helpful in coping with these difficult feelings. And just talking about what you're feeling with others can help too. So simply make an intentional effort to ask those around you how they're doing. And in return, be honest about how you're doing. And by normalizing these conversations and modeling vulnerability, you can reduce stigma and help others feel more comfortable sharing. And as this pandemic continues on, you know, we need to embrace a new normal. because it spurred attention to both physical and mental health, we're preparing for a new normal outlook on life. And mental health is more important now than ever. So look for new opportunities as we navigate this time, rather than grieve the past. This year can be proactive, not only in academic achievement, but also, you know, students should look toward their mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual health.
So important. I want to kind of focus on the question that comes up, and it reflects to Nan's story and when she was looking for help. What resources are available for parents and students in Jacksonville specifically?
Yeah, and when you're talking about resources when you're not in a crisis, you know, there are places that kids can call. They can call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline and talk to someone anytime. They can also go to websites out there. There's some really good ones, okaytotalk.org or reachout.com. And there are websites that are messages about from other kids and posts about how they're feeling. So that helps them feel more accepted in their emotions. Families themselves, like Nan, sometimes are at a loss when their loved one goes through emotional crisis like this. And families can call NAMI Jacksonville, and they can call our helpline. We've got a phone and a telephone number and an email to get resources or just find somebody to talk through the process. We also have support groups for families and family-to-family classes where families can learn the symptoms of mental illness, understand brain changes that accompany it, how to communicate with your child and ultimately support them through their journey, as well as find support and camaraderie among other families, which is incredibly important for a family member to take care of themselves so that they're able to take care of their loved one.
Ms. Manley, what was that? What would be that website, just so that we air it at this time?
Sure. NAMI Jacksonville itself is www.NAMIJAX.org. Our helpline can be reached at helpline@NAMIJAX.org or 904-724-7782. And I wanted to mention for families with younger children, I know that's sometimes very difficult to navigate with a young child, but NAMI has a 6-week class called Basics that can be completed online. And it's for parents of youth who are experiencing mental health conditions.
I appreciate this. And this is so great. And I imagine all of this information's on the website. So I would ask our listeners to direct them over there. I want to make one extra point. I understand that there is an upcoming NAMI walk coming on October 9th. I want to make sure that we work that in before we finish our conversation today.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that. NAMI Jacksonville is hosting our second annual NAMI Walks. Our first one came in 2020, which, as you can imagine, we had to pivot to a virtual walk. So this year we are very excited. It's coming up on October 9th, 2021 at the Winston Family YMCA, where we're all going to walk a 5K in solidarity for mental health. The funds go directly towards our local nonprofit grassroots organization so that we can provide the free support groups and classes and programs that we provide to our community. So we hope that you'll come out and walk with us on walk day. You can find information at NAMIWalks.org/Jacksonville.
I love it. I hope everyone is out there. This is such an important cause. I want to thank Nan. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm just so happy that that your children are doing well now. And to Ms. Maylou, thank you so much for this terrific resources. We appreciate you both coming on today's show with us.
Thank you so much.
And thanks.
Yes,
and
you thanks. Dr. Servin.
It is a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us. And up next, recent high school graduates learn to manage their health care. We'll be right back.
The most common developmental and mental health conditions reported in public school students was ADHD, followed by autism spectrum disorders, anxiety, depression, and bipolar disorder.
Welcome back. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which examines where and how healthcare intersects with your life. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a local neurologist, and thanks for listening. Having gone through this myself, I can state that one of the most emotionally charged life events is when your child goes off to live away from home for the first time, either for college or a gap year or for work. And when there are health concerns, the stress is magnified. But there are few manuals on how to cope with the situation. So how do you manage this? Well, to help us illuminate this part from an experiential standpoint, our own First Coast Connect host, Melissa Ross, and her daughter, Natalie, who's taking a gap year before heading to college in Charleston, are here now to talk about how new adults, just starting out on their own, can take responsibility for their health care. So to Natalie and Melissa, it is a pleasure to have you today.
Hi, Dr. Servin. It's good to be with you. Hey, Natalie.
Hi.
It's good to have you both here. And we'll start off with you, Natalie. Before graduating from school, did your parents prepare you on how to manage your own health care?
Yes, they did. They were very articulate in the importance of good health and maintaining that. In terms of just obviously outside of all the COVID precautions that are being taken now, but just good exercise and taking your vitamins and whatnot. And my mother accompanied me on almost all of my medical visits and just, you know, helped me to get familiar with the ropes of making appointments and dealing with people at the counter. So, yes, they did.
I love hearing that. I have you all nice and prepped. Melissa, I'm curious, what conversations did you have with Natalie about all those healthcare system things, the records, consent, scheduling, where to go for care?
Well, you know what? I'll tell you, there's probably a lot more I should have told her that I haven't. I mean, because until she left home, I was the one always doing everything, you know, making the appointments, making the phone calls, getting her prescriptions, because she does have a few health conditions that we've had to manage, as you know.
Yeah.
And so now that she's away for the first time, I've had conversations with her about just being proactive, about continuing to take her medication, letting me know if there's anything that, you know, becomes an issue. And honestly, I think there's still a lot more that I need to discuss with her because navigating the healthcare system is hard. And, you know, if she needs help while she's away, I'm not right there anymore. Right. So she's going to, I mean, I have full confidence that she can handle things. She's really got a lot of maturity for her age. I mean, she drove all the way up to Maine by herself.
Wow.
And,
wow.
But, you know, you worry as a mom always. And yeah, I mean, I think there's still a lot of work to be done in getting her feeling more that she's completely now in charge of managing her health. We're not there yet.
No, I get it. I'm thinking even as an adult, navigating the system has its tricks. Natalie, you know, what healthcare challenges do you think you might run into living away from home? And more importantly, how do you plan to deal with them?
I think it might be a little bit of a challenge to get some of my prescriptions, but hopefully not too big of a challenge. I say that it would be a challenge because my mother is still refilling my prescriptions at our pharmacy in Florida, and I'm living up in Maine. So in order to get them when I've, you know, finished taking them, I'd have to send the empty bottles down in the mail and so forth, and she'd have to send them back up. But I guess a resolution to any issues that would be encountered, and that would just be communicating with my mom and with the pharmacy and maybe the U.S. Postal Service if it got out of hand, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
But other than that little bit, any challenges? I guess, you know, if God forbid, but if I were to get, like, sick while I was away, you know, anything that went beyond just a little cold, I guess I would have to go to the nearest healthcare facility or hospital. And lucky for me, there's a Mayo Clinic right here in the town where I'm staying. So I guess just being aware of the resources that are available to you and in your area, whether it's, you know, at a college, your schools, you know, clinic. And, you know, just being in tune with your own physical well-being, because you're just going to have to be more conscious of it on your own instead of when you were at home. It wasn't as big of a deal, you know, because you weren't responsible for your medicines and your food. It was being provided for you. So just awareness and research.
I love how you've stated that. That's always the biggest issue. Melissa, in our last few moments, for parents who are navigating this, any quick words of advice?
I was terrified when she left home. I held my breath for 5 days until she made it to her destination. I still worry. Like she said, though, you just have to stay in touch with your child, and you just have to communicate with their healthcare provider, whoever that is. And at the same time, you have to start the process of letting go a little bit. And that's been hard, but it's got to be done. And, you know, she's doing great on her own. And, you know, we'll see her at Thanksgiving. And That's all I can. I will have an update for you soon.
I'll look forward to that in the future. So, Natalie, thank you so much for joining us. Melissa, thank you so much for sharing this.
Thank you.
This has been terrific and a nice way to kind of help everyone out there. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, that's our program for today. If you missed anything, you can catch the rebroadcast tomorrow at 9 p.m. or listen to the full program at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests and social media participants. Our senior producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our associate producer is Catherine Hobbs. If you have questions or comments or a medical question for a future show on what's health got to do with it, call us at 904-358-6362 or send an email to health@wjct.org. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and keep in touch.
This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today.